Schrott against Bristol Myers. Mr. Cashin.
Good morning, and may it please the court. It's my privilege and honor to appear before you this morning. I'd like to begin with a very brief statement of what we're seeking by reason of this appeal. We're saying that if this lady, the plaintiff, had been informed by her doctors of the matters which she claimed were concealed by the defendant drug company and should not have been concealed, and if the plaintiff had been informed of these matters, either by her doctor or the drug company, she wouldn't have had the implants in the first place. That's specifically pleaded in the complaint at paragraphs 103 and 104. If she never had the implants in the first place, she would never suffered any surgical pain, which persisted for a long time, and expert testimony should not be necessary on that issue. She also would not have experienced a fear of being subjected to cancer, and that's clear from the pleadings too. I say this because we have not appealed Judge Conlon's ruling on the exclusion of Dr. Brautbar, particularly with respect to the limited aspect of Judge Conlon's ruling, neurogenic syncope, dizziness, and unilateral drooping of her face, one side. I'd like to talk about tolling for a moment, if I may. At page 20 of the defendant's brief, they talk about MDL 926. This is a multi-district class action, and there was an order entered in this case, which defendant concedes was entered, in January of 1992, tolling the statute of limitations. Tolling's the point from which the statute begins to run. The plaintiff filed less than 2 years after that point. Now, we claim that the PACER system here in the federal system is a pretty good one, and that the orders that are in that system can easily be accessed and are reliable, but that one order of January 1992 is quite clear. I'm going to go into why I think this is pertinent.
But, of course, the January 92 order doesn't revive a case. It's already late.
Well, I don't know exactly what the effect of that is.
Well, look, suppose a case arose in 1981 and the statute unequivocally was over by 1983. The fact that this order was entered in 1992 would have no effect whatsoever on that case. It's over and done with.
I can't deal with
you
that.
You don't agree with that?
Not really, because toxic torts are a much different situation, Your Honor. This is not exactly a clear-cut situation in any respect. Now, I know that's hard to accept, but that's what my argument is going to be here. But
your argument has to be that the claim hadn't accrued yet, but I'm just giving you a simple hypothetical where it's clear that the claim accrued as of 1981 and that the two-year statute in Illinois was over by 1983, and I was just trying to establish
in my case, rule
that a 1992 order in an MDL can't revive a case that, under the principles that apply, has already passed its time.
She had the first implants in June of 1987.
I know that. I mean, I realized. I was just trying to make it a little simpler.
Oh, you were making
anyway,
you weren't referring to
that's
my
That's what
case.
I meant by hypothetical.
Well, I pass on to the Gradel rule, which I argued. And that has to do with continuing violation. And the court, the Illinois court in that case.
One more question about this tolling. These are claims under Illinois law. Does Illinois, as a matter of its domestic law, recognize the supposed tolling effect of class actions in other jurisdictions?
No.
So what is the significance of this class action? Since under Erie, everything depends on Illinois law, if Illinois doesn't recognize it, it's
well, I don't think I was going to get to that later, but basically my point on that is that once it's in the case is in the federal system for good, the federal rule of tolling ought to be applied. Otherwise, there's no federal uniformity in the class action.
There's not supposed to be any uniformity under Erie. Everything depends on state law. The doctrine to which you're referring is a tolling rule that was developed for use by federal courts in claims arising under federal law. Claims arising under state law, there are as many as 50 different rules, and under Erie, we're supposed to apply them all. So I come back to my question. If, as a matter of its own domestic law, Illinois does not recognize the tolling effect of class actions in other jurisdictions, what significance could this have?
Well, let me point out that denial in Illinois of cross-jurisdictional tolling is based on that Portwood case. And the Portwood case did not cite an important federal case, Chardon versus DeSoto.
Illinois does not have to follow any other jurisdiction's law.
Well, on this small point, I would just like to point out that in that Chardon case, Judge Stevens said that after a dismissal in federal court other than on the merits, the state saving statute applied. That point was not present in the Portwood decision at all, even though the case was refiled in the Illinois state court within a year after the dismissal in federal court, which was not on the merits. But my point there is that even under Portwood, there's an opportunity, which was not stated in Portwood, but it's stated in the Chardon case, of refiling, and so that dismissal in Portwood in the federal system really was not the end of the story in terms of limitations, because the state rule would allow that.
You're speculating that the Illinois Supreme Court, if presented with a somewhat different take on this, might say something different. It did say pretty unequivocally in Portwood that a federal class action did not toll a putative class member's state law claim. That's about as clear as it can be. Now, maybe they think about it again. Any court is certainly entitled to do so, but as a federal court looking at all of this, it's risky for us to disregard something from the highest court of a state on the hypothetical possibility that they might modify the rule.
Well, that hypothetical possibility has to be related to United States Supreme Court case.
No, it doesn't.
That
not
right
for a
there.
State law matter.
It doesn't.
I mean, if they're speaking about the meaning of the federal constitution, of course the Illinois Supreme Court has to take into account the U.S. Supreme Court statutes, etc. But when they're talking about something that is well within the power of the state, namely the law of tort and the statutes of limitations that go along with it, they get to make up the rules.
Well, I do point out in my brief that so far as the Consumer Fraud Action theory is concerned, that was filed within 3 years of the last tortious act. And in Gradel, the last tortious act occurs at the time that the offending drug is taken off the market. In this particular case, all manufacturing of the MEM implant ceased in April of 1991. Therefore, this case that was filed November 8, 1993, was filed within 3 years, but not within 2 years. So, aside from Gradel, we must argue the discovery rule in this case as well, just as was argued in Gradel. But for the defense to say that Gradel did not hold that the last tortious act rule in a continuing violation sets the start point of the period of limitation, I believe, is incorrect. Her testimony in terms of her discovery was that when she had that right breast implant replacement surgery in November of 1989, her treating physician told her before the surgery there was nothing wrong with the implant, and told her the same thing after the surgery, and told her that her pain that she had been experiencing was her pain from the original surgery in June of 1987 and constituted surgical healing. Now, this may sound unusual that my client would think that 2 years and 4 months after her original implant, she talks to her doctor, she's still having these problems, and he's saying, well, it's the pain from the surgery. But there's an inference here in favor of the plaintiff. People tend to believe their doctors. If she believed their her doctor, and she's a fairly young person at this stage, that is something that is a reasonable inference, I suggest, in her favor. If we look at the Illinois decisions on this, I say that there are a couple of inferences here. First, that the side effects of her surgery, which she discussed with her doctor, didn't necessarily alert her to the possibility that something about the implants themselves was actionable, and that the side effects, while they might be distressing, also might be considered medically normal in that context. That's almost an exact quote from a case called Hill versus Pettipatti. Also, I think that's a reasonable inference that it didn't alert her. Also, there's another inference that some short period of time prior to the time that she had her explant surgery of both implants in January of 1993, some short period of time before that, she realized that the implants were unacceptable in some way and had to be removed. I think that's an inference that a jury could reasonably accept. And I think that both these inferences bear on the discovery rule. And we know that the Illinois rule says that a mere suspicion that one is injured wrongfully caused is not enough to amount to constructive knowledge of the wrongfulness of it. Having discussed the Riddell statute of limitations issue and the discovery rule issue, I want to just point out that Judge Conlon felt that the consumer fraud and negligent infliction of mental suffering cases couldn't be pleaded in this federal case. This has to do with the effect of an Illinois statute on voluntary dismissal. And this has to do with the Illinois law on denial of leave to amend. A denial of leave to amend is not a judgment on the merits. The purpose of the voluntary dismissal statute is to give a plaintiff's lawyer like me extra breathing room, extra time, and to relieve the difficulties of an improper timeliness that occurred in the first case. No Illinois court has ever held that denial of the leave to amend is a judgment on the merits. And so that includes the right then to have theories of recovery in the second case filed, which was denied in the first case for lack of timeliness. Claim preclusion in Illinois is governed strictly by res judicata principles as defined in Illinois law, and it allows any theory of recovery in a second case or a later case based on the same core of operative facts as in the original action. Another point that I would like to bring up is in the event of reversal by this court, there were issues on psychiatric testimony and fear of cancer that are really governed by Illinois law. The Illinois Rita case does not allow psychiatric testimony. This is not strictly a rule of evidence. This is built into the substantive right that plaintiffs have, any plaintiff in Illinois trial court, does not subject himself or herself to being deposed or voluntarily being required or compelled to testify to psychological matters and have that as part of the trial in the case. The Rita case is quite clear that the plaintiff has to voluntarily open up that issue or in some positive way, as opposed to accidental way or an inadvertent way, waive it. And also...
Thank you, Mr. Cash.
Yes. Am I through? Thank you.
Mr. Pratt.
Thank you. May it please the court. There's been a lot of talk here from Mr. Cashin into the brief about statute of limitations. I want to propose to the court that there are two easy ways to affirm the judgment in this case without even addressing the statute of limitations. This is a personal injury case in which the plaintiff claims that the implants that she had, through some mechanisms of chemicals being eluted from the implants, caused her to have damage in the area of her breast and in other parts of her body. There's no question that in a personal injury case, you have to present expert testimony that the product at question caused the injury at issue. Plaintiff knows that because that's why they presented Dr. Brautbar. Dr. Brautbar was excluded. In the lower court level, we argued that Dr. Brautbar wasn't qualified to make that causative link. He was the only expert presented on that. The question of qualifications was not even addressed by the plaintiff in the lower court, has not been addressed here on appeal. Judge Conlon found that Dr. Brautbar was not qualified. So whether you're dealing with federal law under Daubert or state law, the failure to present a qualified expert to support a causative link in a personal injury action is fatal to the case. That in and of itself dooms every one of the claims that the plaintiff has presented. The second easy way to do it is to apply Daubert to this federal diversity case. I think there can be really no question that a federal court sitting in diversity applies the Daubert elements. I mean, that's what Daubert and Joyner and Kumho Tyre did at the Supreme Court, applied it to diversity cases. The plaintiff argues it has no place in a case like this. A federal court somehow cannot apply Daubert.
That you might mean Rule 702, I would imagine, by now, since it has been... It's the operative rule at the moment, not just the Supreme Court's Daubert decision.
Yes, and so they are asking you essentially to sort of judicially overrule 702, 703. But if this court concludes that Daubert applies to this case, which I submit is the only reasonable conclusion, then the case is over. Because they've made no effort to establish that Dr. Brautbar met any of the elements of Daubert. They never argued anything other than Daubert doesn't apply.
I will try once again. The operative rule is Rule 702. It changes Daubert in part, codifies it in part, but in any event, that's just a decision of the Supreme Court. The rule of law is Federal Rule of Evidence 702.
Implying 702 to this case, as Judge Conlon found, results in Dr. Brautbar being stricken, leaving the plaintiff with no expert to support causation. Therefore, the claims are legitimately disposed of. The third, let me submit, basis, independent of statute of limitations for this court to affirm the judgment, is that we argued in the lower court on summary judgment that plaintiff had not presented sufficient evidence on the merits of the claims. Whether it's a negligence claim, whether it's a consumer fraud claim, whether it's a strict liability claim, we saw flaws and gaps in the elements of proof. We argued to the Judge Conlon that they'd not presented sufficient evidence. On questions of failure to warn, design defect, there's no question that experts are required on that subject as well. That's what the Northern Trust case says out of the Supreme Court of Illinois.
Mr. Pratt, could I ask you whether there's something you don't like about your statute of limitations argument that causes you to draw these other points?
Not at all.
I want to make sure I'm not drawing the wrong inference.
No, absolutely not, and I'll get to it, Your Honor, but the question of the merits is that they have to present expert testimony, and Judge Conlon was right. when they failed to present evidence to establish that there was an inadequate warning or the design was unreasonably dangerous. Yes, I think that on that basis alone, additionally, Judge Conlon was right. Statute of limitations. I'll be glad if you get to it. Statute of limitations, it's divided up into two or three different things. The statute of limitations with respect to warranty is gone because it's 4 years from the tender of delivery. The implants were placed in 1987. No question that 4 years had passed before this case was filed. There was an implant placed in 1989, and as Judge Conlon noted, there was no proof by the plaintiff on when that was tendered. So there's no evidence that it was filed within 4 years of tender.
Clear it's delivery to the doctor, not, in a sense, delivery
yes.
to the patient?
Yes, yes. With respect to the consumer fraud statute of limitations, this case was filed in 1993. It wasn't until 9 years later when they tried to add a consumer fraud claim. And when they dismissed the case, having lost the opportunity to amend it, they added a consumer fraud claim. Essentially, in March of 2002, the Circuit Court of Cook County said that it's too late, you waived it. And somehow 9 months later, it's refiled in state court with that added. I don't think there's any, or the Hamilton case says that when you take a look at the two cases, the original case is filed and the refiled case, there has to be, as they quote, an identical claim and cause of action set up in the second one. I don't think that you can have a lawsuit filed in 1993, try to amend it in 2002, dismiss it after that, and then refile it 9 months later and claim that it's timely and that it somehow relates back to the 1993 case. I don't think there's any basis for that rule. The Supreme Court, Illinois Supreme Court 219E says that you cannot avoid an order by voluntarily dismissing. Now, personal injury, discovery rule. 2 year statute of limitations, you know the rules. I mean, it accrues on the date of injury, but if you also, on the discovery rule, it accrues on the date that you know you have an injury and knew or should have known that injury was wrongfully caused. That's the discovery rule. Now, the standard, though, is, you know, you don't have to know actually. I mean, as the court has said, this court in Wagar said, the realization that someone might be legally responsible will trigger it. As the Golda Illinois Appellate Court said, actionable conduct may be involved, and that will trigger the statute of limitation. What we have here in 1987 is an implant that's placed in this plaintiff. She starts having pain. The pain doesn't get better, the pain gets worse. It becomes excruciating as the months and the years pass in the area of her breast around these implants, the pain becomes excruciating. The tissue in her breast around the implant begin to harden. It becomes more painful. Then the right implant starts to move. It moves, as she alleges, under the arm. There's no statement here, as in some of the cases cited by the plaintiff, or the doctor is saying to the plaintiff, don't worry about this, it has nothing to do with the implant, it just relates to the surgery. There's nothing like that in this case whatsoever. And I think what Judge Conlon concluded, and I think the reasonable conclusion from this, is that if something is put in your body and you claim that you got no warnings about any ill effects that may happen to you once it's in your body, and that starts hurting, and it starts hurting more, and it starts hardening around it, and it starts moving, and no one is telling you it's unrelated to the implant, the reasonable person, I think, not the plaintiff, because that's not the standard, the objective, reasonable person is going to say to himself or herself, something's going on here. Something's going on. And she has surgery to remove the right implant. After that, still we're dealing outside of the limitations period here. She has surgery to remove the right implant. She has significant scarring from that. She claims she's horrified by how she looks. All outside the trigger date of the statute of limitations. And when you take a look at all this put together, I think the conclusion is that she clearly knew enough, or a reasonable person would have known enough, to be put on inquiry that there was some actionable conduct with respect to this implant and maybe the company who made it. It's not a type of case like Hill versus Petipati, where the patient is going through radiation therapy, where people say, yeah, of course you have some pain with radiation, and the doctor's saying, yeah, you can have some pain with radiation, but they don't find out until some months later that there's a broken bone. Now, the statement about the doctor, and I want to be very clear on this. Mr. Cashin talked about what the implanting doctor had to say. The implanting doctor, Dr. Stephen Block, certainly dooms their failure to warn claim. He says, I based my judgment to put implants in her on my own information, not on what the company told me. But he did not say implants were safe. He never told her that the problems she was having were unrelated to the implant. He never said that the implants were not causing the problems in 1989, and that's a key point, because what happened in 1989 was she goes in because the right implant is moved. She goes in to have surgery. They think it may be ruptured. And the doctor says it may be ruptured. And she says, if it's ruptured, I don't want another implant in my body. I'm scared. Still outside the statute of limitations. I'm scared of it. I don't want to want it. So when she comes out of surgery, the doctor has taken out the implant and put another implant in. So the logical inquiry after that pre-surgery dialogue is, how was that right implant? And his statement that there was nothing wrong with it, clearly in the context of his testimony, is that it wasn't ruptured, and it wasn't ruptured. In no way can that be read to say that all the problems you were having with the excruciating pain, you can't lay on your stomach, you can't wear a bra because your breast hurt, has nothing to do with that implant. There's no reasonable interpretation from Dr. Block's testimony to that effect. Even if Dr. Block said what Mr. Cashin wished he had said, that doesn't affect the manufacturer. And I commend the court to this case called Witherell versus Warner versus Ortho, in which a plaintiff took a birth control pill, had a stroke, and the doctor's saying, no, you have a muscle condition. It's not anything related to the implant, to the birth control pills. Well, as to him, he was a stop from saying it started at the time of the stroke. But the court held that as to Ortho, the manufacturer, this doctor wasn't their agent. So what he had to say had no effect on delaying the running of the statute of limitations as to them. So even if Dr. Block said the kinds of things that Mr. Cashin said he may have said, that doesn't result in a tolling of the statute as to the doctor, as to the drug company. Now, I want to talk a minute about the fear of cancer claim on the merits, because the claim here is that there's some negligent infliction of emotional distress. Clearly, expert testimony is required. But the procedure in the Northern District is that when you file a motion for summary judgment, you have to lay out uncontroverted statements of facts. We did this. We did 60, 61 or something like that. The duty is then to controvert it if you're the other side. You've got to step up and say, that's not true, or it is true. If you say it's not true, you've got to explain your version and support it with facts. Our statements of fact were not controverted by the plaintiff. Therefore, they were all deemed admitted. So all this talk about how chemicals were emitting from these implants, we made the statement that there's no evidence that her implants emitted chemicals like cayuine, diamine, TDI, the things that they think are involved. They didn't controvert it. So it's deemed admitted that it did not emit it. We also had the uncontroverted fact that there wasn't enough of this chemical to be medically significant to the plaintiff. They didn't controvert it. It's admitted. But significantly on the fear of cancer claim, there is such a claim in Illinois, no question about it. Majka says that you've got to have exposure and you've got to have a reasonable fear. Exposure, reasonable fear. Exposure has been admitted away because they said in the uncontroverted facts they have no evidence that there was TDA released from her implants. We also said in an uncontroverted fact that plaintiff has no quantifiable increased risk of any future illness, including cancer. Uncontroverted, deemed admitted. So on both elements of Majka, exposure, reasonable of risk, and proof of risk, tied together. They failed to present evidence. Worse than that, they have admitted that they have no such evidence. I think with respect to just to wrap things up on the summary judgment side of things, unless the court has some questions about it, I think you can look at this and say the failure to controvert the facts justify, without regard to statute of limitations, the affirmance of Judge Conlon's order and the judgment entered in this case. The need for an expert on the medical, on the causative link, the need for an expert on failure to warn under Northern Trust, the need for an expert on whether the information was sufficient enough to justify a warning, and they have no experts on any of that, independently justifies an affirmance. And the statute of limitations, I think, is right with respect to the 2-year personal injury, the 3-year consumer fraud, and the 4-year warranty action. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. The case is taken under advisement. We'll hear argument now in the case of Segan against Chippewa Falls.